Cape Talk. Call Pippa now on 021 446 0567.
Right, now a question came into Consumer Talk last week about what to do when a home you've bought and moved into turns out to have defects that weren't disclosed to you prior to the sale. And I did comment at the time, I thought it was worth following up in our legal segment, and I'm happy to do so today as we contemplate some of the broader legal issues around buying a home. We'll be happy to take any additional questions you might have about the process of buying a home. If you want to ask a question, you can do what several people have already done, send a WhatsApp to 072-567-1567. You're also very welcome to call in on 021-446-0567. With me on the line is Andrew Smith, who's the director at Dunoon, Sampson & Lawvu Incorporated, who are conveyancing attorneys. And Andrew, it's great to have you with us today. Thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us.
Thank you, Pippa, and thank you for inviting me to join you.
It's a pleasure. For most people, buying a house is the biggest purchase they will ever make, Andrew. It's one that commits you to long-term consequences if things go wrong. Before we look at any specific listener questions about the difficulties they've encountered, do you maybe want to start with a broad picture of a couple of the basics that all potential buyers need to be aware of before they sign an offer to purchase? What will you be required to pay, to commit to? Are there any hidden costs that more people need to know about, for example?
Thanks, Pippa. The first thing that we need to point out is a sale agreement for immovable property or fixed property, as some of us know it as, must be in writing, and it must be signed in what we call wet ink, in other words, with a pen, not a computer.
Okay.
Then you can sign it with a private deal with a seller, if you know a seller who's selling his property, or you can go through an estate agent. It really makes very little difference. Okay. So going back to your question, when you sign a sale agreement, before you sign that offer, it's very, very important that you have a proper look at the house and you see what condition it's in. There's case law to the effect that one is expected to look behind furniture to see if there are any defects that you're not going to be happy with.
Mm-hmm.
So when you buy a property in South Africa, we've got this very old Roman Dutch law maxim called footstoots.
Yeah.
You buy a property footstoots, you buy it as you see it. So you generally can't go back to the seller and say, no, but there's damp behind the kitchen cupboard, for example, because you are deemed to have looked at the property to your satisfaction before you put pen to paper.
That's really important, Andrew. So the example that our listener quoted in that question they sent last week of only discovering defects further down the line after they'd moved in, is it too bad? You should have been looking for those before you signed the offer to purchase.
You should have satisfied yourself as to the condition of the property beforehand. But there are examples. Say, for example, you're buying a property in Cape Town. I'm based in Sandton. Mm-hmm. If you're buying a property in Cape Town in summer and there hasn't been much rain around, and suddenly the rain starts in winter and you have a roof that's a little bit like one of those kitchen colanders, then that's something that should have been disclosed, because that's not something that the purchaser would easily have noticed.
Yeah.
Unless there's water marks along the ceiling and the upper edge of the walls, then you would be able to see it. But if there's no such marks like that, then a purchaser wouldn't know that the roof is leaking.
Yeah.
So there are different examples. There was an interesting case a couple of years ago where an owner, the house was built on the edge of a steep hill.
Yeah.
And the owner realized that the stilts that the house was on in the front were subsiding, and the floor was subsiding. So what they did is they put a false floor in to make it level, and then realized that the ceiling was also subsiding, so they put a false ceiling in to make that level, and then sold the property. And the purchasers soon realized that there was something a bit odd about this house. It was from the outside, it was an angle, and from the inside, it was square. And that went to court, and court found in favor of the purchasers and ruled against the seller. So the seller was liable for repairing that damage.
Okay, so there have been cases where if somebody really knowingly hid a defect, they can be held to account after the fact. That's quite reassuring to hear. I mean, in your opinion, Andrew, we've had several guests say to us it really pays to spend getting a professional property inspection done before you commit to buying a house to look for things like that. Would you agree?
I have two thoughts about that. The idea and principle is really good because most purchasers don't know what to look for.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, a lot of these companies that do those kind of inspections, a lot of the reports I've seen are they look for silly things. So you end up getting this long list, which immediately puts the purchaser off. But it's not realistic. When you're buying a secondhand property, you're buying a secondhand property. You're not buying from the developer. So you've got to expect that it's not going to be 100% perfect. But these reports, they come along and they mention all sorts of silly things. And it puts the potential purchaser off. And the problem is, after that, the agent and the seller knows of all these strange things that these people have raised, and when you're trying to market the place again, you're almost compelled
to disclose
these silly things, and it makes it very difficult for a seller to then eventually sell their property because there's all these question marks. So yes, the idea of a home inspection type crowd is a lot of merit in it, but I don't think it's being used in the right way.
Okay,
that's my view. Yeah.
Thanks for that, Andrew. Somebody's asking whether the onus is on the seller to declare any asbestos in a building to a buyer when it's sold. Any comment on that?
There's no specific onus on a seller to declare that.
Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah. There's I've never heard of anything like that.
Okay.
There is an onus to declare alien species of plants.
Really?
The seller is aware of it. It's new legislation that came about 4 years ago, but it's been downplayed a hell of a lot. So there's not a lot of people are making a fuss about it.
Okay. Andrew, the one thing that is absolutely required are the compliance certificates for the electricity, the gas works, the pest control, etc. And it's quite interesting that a number of the questions and complaints that we've received have been around those certificates. A comment in from Justin in Fishhook, who reckons homeowners should get the compliance certificates before putting the house on the market. That way, if they do need to fix anything, they can do so cost effectively before then trying to sell the property and potentially having to deal with things at great expense. But here's an interesting perspective from Mary, who tells us her daughter recently bought a house which had all of its compliance certificates in place, but when she brought her own electrician in to do some additional work after they'd moved in, that electrician turned around and said there's no way this electrical setup is compliant. The earth leakage and the stove insulation, for example, were not compliant. And she said, what are we to do in a case like this? We know the sellers spent something like 20,000 Rand getting that electrical certificate, but it sounds like it wasn't worth the paper it was printed on. Any comment on the right thing to do in a case like that?
Yeah. The regulations under which electrical compliance certificates are issued actually fall within the Department of Labor. And the Department of Labor has actually outsourced to various reputable people in the electrical business. They've outsourced the task of policing electricians' certificates.
Okay.
Because it's a big problem. In my practice, I have many purchasers complaining about the validity of an electrical compliance certificate. It is a big problem. Unfortunately, although the regulations are pretty clear on what can be done and what can't be done, electricians very often interpret things their own way. And So one electrician will see something that to him looks perfectly safe, and the next electrician will come along and he doesn't believe it's safe. So you have differing interpretations regarding the regulations. So there's that to it. And then there's the quality of not all the quality of all the electricians is the same. They don't understand the regulations as much as the next guy, perhaps. So there's been many, many question marks over electrical compliance certificates over many years. It's a very big problem. So what I say to purchasers when they ask me how this certificate could have been issued, I had a question mark like that earlier, or late last week or early this week. And I say, well, your first point of call is to get hold of one of these people that the Department of Labor has passed this duty onto. And ask them to come and inspect. There will be a charge. They will charge, but you know, I think the fee might be 2,000 or 3,000 rand, and when you compare that to the safety of your family, it's money well spent. Yeah. They will come around and they will do an inspection. They will prepare quite a detailed report, and unlike these home inspection type crowds, they're pretty much to the point, the ones that I've seen. And they will then contact the electrician and ask him to come and remedy the work that they found that wasn't up to standard. And if he doesn't come and remedy it, they can have him his license taken away by the Department of Labor, or the Department of Labor can fine them.
Okay.
So there is that protection for the purchaser who's been issued with an electrical compliance certificate where the electrician hasn't checked properly.
Okay, thanks for clarifying that. For those who've joined us late to the conversation, my guest on the line is Andrew Smith, who's a director at Dunoon, Sampson and Lovu Incorporated, conveyancing attorneys. Andrew, you've got a couple of questions that have come in as voice notes. Let's take a listen to one or two of those.
Okay.
Hi. Something that caught us by surprise or cancelled us a bit was when we bought our house, we've already taken transfer, when we moved in, and we started having to pay occupational rent, and we didn't know why, because the house could not be transferred to us. Subsequently, we found out that the previous owners owed more than 80,000 rand on their municipal rates, and they were waiting for their loan approval from the bank for their new house to use that money to pay off the municipal bill before we could actually start paying and take ownership of the house. So we ended up paying 3 or 4 months occupational rent, which could have gone straight to our bond, and there was lawyers involved and everything, but we did not know that, and we were already moved in, staying in the house, so we had to pay occupational rent. So that's something to watch out for before you take ownership or before you move in.
Thank you for that voice note. Andrew, very quickly before we're out of time, do you want to just speak to the issue of occupational rent and what it is and when it comes
yes.
due?
Yeah. So when you make your offer, or as part of the process of negotiating the eventual agreement, once you've made your offer, there might be a clause in the agreement providing for occupation other than on date of registration of transfer. And if there is such a clause, then it will provide what the occupational rent would be. So that's very important to look out for, a clause like that, because you could end up having to pay money that you didn't expect to pay if you end up having to move in early because the transfer is taking longer than it should. Now, registration of a transfer should take about 3 months. Realistically, it should take about 3 months. But it can take a lot longer, and there really aren't any guarantees on how long a transfer can take, because there are issues where there are problems with the municipality, or there could be other issues as well. There might be a deceased estate involved in the whole thing, and then you've got to deal with the master of the High Court. So there are issues that could delay a transfer. But then there are many transfers that go through in 2 months. Okay. Mm-hmm. But it really is what that gent should have done is if he was running into 4 months that he'd been paying occupational rent, he should have actually placed the seller on terms to sort out his issues.
Okay.
So that he could pass transfer. So it's not the purchaser's problem that the seller has an old account or an account that's really overdue. It's the seller's issue, and the purchaser would be perfectly within his rights to place the seller on terms to pass transfer within a reasonable time.
Andrew, we have to leave it there due to time constraints, but thank you. You've been incredibly helpful, and I hope it's a conversation we can continue because there are still questions streaming in. There's clearly a high demand for this kind of information, and I'm very happy to schedule a follow-up conversation with Andrew. I'm going to put you back to my producer to have a conversation about that, please. In the meantime, though, thank you so much for the questions you've tackled already today. Andrew Smith, Director at Dunoon, Sampson & Lawvu Incorporated, Conveyancing Attorneys.